my driver in restorative justice is to restore. And I think restorative, even in the language itself, is bringing you back to who you are and not just rehabilitative. So there was power there. So I think it's an empowering process for all that are involved. And it releases those who are survivors of harm, who can put themselves in a prison of fear, hatred, anger. And so I think both parties benefit, at least in some of the processes I've been blessed to be a part of.
The Center for Understanding and Conflict welcomes you to The Other Chair, a monthly podcast exploring the dynamics of conflict and how to bring the human issues to the table. Together with our guests, we explore how the power of understanding each other can lead to better solutions for people on both sides of an issue. We will also share tips for managing your own mediation practice, approaching conflict in the professional world, and ways to apply our understanding-based model in your personal life. Hello to our listeners, and welcome to The Other Chair. My name is James Dyke. Today's guests are Earl Sims and Aaron Kennedy from Restorative Community Solutions, a San Francisco Bay Area nonprofit organization uplifting communities through restorative justice practice. Aaron and Earl focus on community coaching, working within systems to encourage change through collaboration, conflict resolution, and community engagement. Hello, Earl and Aaron, and welcome to The Other Chair.
Thank you, James. We're happy to be here.
Yeah. Hey, James. Thanks for having us.
Of course. Thank you for being here. Maybe we could start out just to tell our listeners a little bit about your organization, just how it came to be, what type of work you do on a regular basis.
Yeah, thank you so much, James. Restorative Community Solutions is a community-based nonprofit organization that Earl and I founded about 2 years ago, doing business in the Bay Area, centered around life coaching and community coaching for communities in settings like the criminal legal system and helping people who are reentering into society after incarceration. We also engage in coaching with systems in government agencies and nonprofits in order to encourage systems collaboration and to try to increase or decrease disparities in the criminal justice system and in the systems that serve community, like the homeless response system.
What's your background? What brought you to this type of work? Do you do other work outside of supporting this organization? What's your professional experience?
Yeah, so I'm actually an attorney. I was trained in Kansas. I'm licensed to practice in Kansas and California. I started my career just practicing law in Kansas. I've got a background in criminal defense work, and I've done some family law work. I moved out to California in 2014, and at that point, I was in a different mind space about how to approach my personal mission, which is to serve communities and serve people who don't have the financial ability to access the justice system. Because I had worked in the justice system, I realized that I could be more effective if I was actually in community-based organizations and I could cast a wider net that way. So since I've been in California, I've worked at several community-based organizations on a number of different projects aimed at kind of getting upstream of the issues that cause people to interface with the criminal legal system. So I've done that in two community-based health centers and a housing provider here in California. So after having worked at those nonprofits, Earl and I met in this work, and we realized that there was a real need for additional community-based organizations that could provide services to the reentry community in a way that would be more restorative and more focused in the community. And so that's why we got together with our vision to create Restorative Community Solutions.
And Earl, I understand that you bring not only your professional experience, but also some personal experience to the organization that helps you in the work that you're doing.
First, I have to, you know, anytime I'm public facing, I definitely want to lift up the other person who was impacted by my actions. And our testimony is, I think, what makes me effective in our story. So I'd like to lift up Alfonso. I'd like to name him. So in 1991, I committed a gang related homicide and was sentenced to 15 years to life for taking Alfonso's life. And so I just, you know, that's the driver. That's what keeps me in this work. So I've served 22 years off of 18 years to life. And during that process, I was able to understand what insight is, what led me to the crime, what led me to the thinking that it was okay for me to take a person's life, and the gang platform, how I was dealing with my own trauma and my unaddressed trauma. And so I formed this persona or this mask in this gang, and it was a perfect platform for someone who's experienced generational trauma, environmental trauma. And so that's how I was initially introduced to restorative practices. While I was sentenced, Alfonso's mother took a forgiving tone and asked the judge not to give me the maximum sentence. And I couldn't understand that. So she planted a seed of what restorative justice looks like for me. I wasn't prepared for that type of response. I was, you know, prepared for that, for hatred and bitterness. And, you know, I could just, that just fed the monster in that mask that I created. So to be able to be accountable to a mother who lost a child is what drives me. And while I'm in this work, that's what keeps me grounded and keeps me focused on making a difference and trying to bring healing into communities.
Thank you, Earl, for sharing a deeply personal story and the impact that it's had on you and the work that you're doing. I wonder if it might be good to take a moment to explore more or to explain more, what is restorative justice and how does the process unfold to help communities work through conflict and to heal together, as you mentioned?
So restorative justice gives the opportunity to focus on the harm and what comes from the harm and address the results of that harm using a collaboration between all that are involved in that situation. And you move into that space seeking to, with the intent of healing. Every time, it's not guaranteed that the end result will be healing. So to move into that space with that intention is incredibly helpful, because that gives you the long-term goal of where you want to go. And hopefully it harness healing on both sides. And I think as far as a community, you know, you think about community, community is connection. And how do we leverage those connections to bring about healing, unity, to address harms that have happened within the community and where it's productive in the long run. And so like restorative justice to me and my driver in restorative justice is to restore. You think about rehabilitation. So I went, I was institutionalized and it was California Department of Corrections, and then they added rehabilitation. And I think restorative, even in the language itself, is bringing you back to who you are and not just rehabilitative, right? So there was power there. So I think it's an empowering process for all that are involved. And it releases those who are survivors of harm, who can put themselves in a prison of fear, hatred, anger. And so I think both parties benefit, at least in some of the processes that I've been blessed to be a part of.
Conflict manifests itself in many ways in our personal lives, for professionals in the workplace and for practitioners who have made a career bringing together parties in conflict through mediation practice. Each month, the Center for Understanding and Conflict hosts live webinars with featured guests discussing best practices and sharing their experiences for tackling conflict using the understanding-based model.
Restorative justice, too, from the legal system's perspective, is an alternative that can be used and is used in many jurisdictions across the United States and actually throughout the world. It's heavily used in Canada, for example, as an alternative to the traditional criminal legal system. And it's actually been shown to be a more effective way to deal with crimes, because restorative justice actually centers the victim's experience and involves the victim in the resolution of the crime. In the traditional and the community, I'd also like to add that part, because a crime involves not only an individual victim, but also the community is impacted by a crime. And so restorative justice's intent is actually to center the victim. In a traditional prosecution, although there are methods in which prosecutors get victim feedback, it isn't the central method by which crimes are resolved. And so there isn't a healing or a restoration that happens as a result of the traditional criminal legal system. Whereas with restorative justice, because the victim is centered and is a critical part of the process of resolving the crime and coming up with what is the most appropriate response to that crime, you get a better outcome for everyone involved in most cases. And we believe, and we think the evidence shows, that tools like restorative justice are essential tools that we have to start to pivot towards if we are ever to resolve the inequities that exist in our criminal legal system, and also, to be honest, in our civil legal system. So for us, and what we've seen and what I've personally seen in the legal system works for a very, very small percentage of people in the United States. Restorative justice is a community-based response where people are solving conflicts in communities like people have been for millennia before the United States legal system was ever developed. So that's another reason that we really believe that restorative justice is effective.
So, you know, my experience in the carceral setting, although the seed was planted in the beginning of that journey, the carceral setting exacerbates existing trauma. So the person that has caused the harm never truly learns what accountability is, because there's more and more trauma that happens in that process and in that journey. One of the things that I've been blessed, and one of the opportunities that I've had since coming home, was to be a fellow in the Safety and Justice Challenge, which we were part of a participatory action research effort to examine alternatives to traditional incarceration or traditional prosecution. And what we found after talking and holding focus groups with survivors, even most of the survivors that we had the chance to talk to in those settings, didn't want extreme punishment. They wanted restorative justice. They felt restorative justice was adequate and a proper approach, because the person that causes the harm understands the nuances of what the survivor has to experience. And like I was saying earlier, you know, you're not prepared for that type of accountability, you know, because we're used to this punitive approach and it's kind of baked into our DNA as a society. So we never understand what it feels like for someone that you've harmed to actually forgive you. It's liberating for both sides.
During this process, do you have the victim and or victim's family and the person who caused that individual harm present in the same space working towards a resolution? Or how does that come together from a kind of a conflict resolution perspective?
One of the things that was super impactful, and I'd like to speak just from my lived experience, that when we were inside, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles had a program where they would bring in survivors to talk to some of the guys that were inside. Majority were lifers. Majority had caused tremendous harm in the community, had been down for a long period of time. And so they brought in mothers who lost their children, very similar to like what our victims or the survivors of our crime experience and their loss with their losing their children. And so it's like a surrogate. You have a surrogate representation of the mother, because a lot of times when you're convicted of such a heinous crime that you can't have access to the victims themselves. So having that surrogate and having that opportunity to learn what that empathetic lens could feel like and look like and see someone express the harm and the pain that's continual 20 years later. You know, a mother brought to tears by the loss of her child. And what we saw was our victims' mothers or the survivors of our harms. We can envision what it felt like for them when we listened to those folks that came in to visit us. And so when you apply that approach out into the community, first, you have to build the capacity of not only the person that's gonna be involved, but the person that has been impacted. So that requires some investment in each side prior to getting into the space where you have these conversations, understanding the boundaries. And like in restorative circles, there are certain parameters. You know, we're all in a circle, everyone's equidistant from the circle. You have a talking point, so there is no big I's, little U's, and everyone has the opportunity to kind of uplift what they're experiencing in that moment.
Yeah, I think what's important about that is that there is the process of restorative justice that's used in programs in the criminal legal system. And generally what Earl's talking about is right. There's a lot of pre-work done because of the trauma and the sensitive nature of what you're trying to do with trained practitioners who, by the way, are culturally competent, ideally. So people from the communities that have been harmed are the ones that are facilitating these conversations, not a judge and a prosecutor and a public defender that are detached from the community. So that's an important thing. And then the other piece is that, like Earl alluded to, restorative justice brings us a set of practices that can be transferred in a variety of settings. So you can use these restorative practices of power sharing, allowing everyone to have an equal voice in the room, the circle, which is a horizontal form of communication rather than a hierarchical form of communication. All of these tools can be used in settings like schools, where they're actively being used to prevent the school to prison pipeline, for example. Earl and I are interested and have been using these tools in our consulting with organizations that are doing really difficult work to try to change systems like the homelessness response systems. And it's really a tool, these tools of restorative practices are essential in creating equity, because really what it comes down to is there's a lot of power sharing that happens. It deconstructs the hierarchy and creates a place where everyone has a voice.
Throughout the year, the Center for Understanding and Conflict hosts in-depth, basic, and advanced certificate programs designed to train you to become effective mediators and conflict resolution professionals centered in the understanding-based model. Our training programs have been the gold standard in alternative dispute resolution for 40 years and is popular within the legal community, with human resource professionals, ombudsmen, and corporate workplace mediation clients. So here at the Center for Understanding and Conflict, in the conflict resolution and mediation training that we host, really the philosophy that underpins that is around understanding. And I hear a lot of parallels in understanding, empathy, being very important to bringing people together, at least having a place to start from. Is there a particular philosophy? I know you talk about tools, but is there a particular model or philosophy that guides the work that you do in communities?
Whenever you're building a conscious relationship between two people, you know, or two parties, it's important that, you know, there's perceived threats on both sides, you know. And if this conflict isn't addressed in a timely manner, they can fester if it's ignored. And so one of the things that I feel is important is co-creating a space. So allowing whoever is involved to co-create a space, like create, in a sense, like a community agreement. What do you need to feel safe? What do you need to feel heard? And once you co-create that space, there's been an investment. So this is a space that we both share. And now we can explore and address some of the things that make you feel threatened. So addressing that fear is essential, because you cannot connect without addressing that fear and creating that safe space to have a conversation. So I definitely lead with some of the foundations the foundation and values of my coaching training, as well as restorative models, which is, you know, you want to bring community in together, establish a safe space, have conversation. And when I say community, that could be two people. And being able to establish that safe space is essential, that authentic relationship that doesn't end at maybe finding healing, because as you heal, it's a continuous process. Things are going to come up. You're going to become re-traumatized. So having that authentic relationship from the beginning is essential in maintaining that relationship. And so once you have one party who has been able to identify what they need to address their perceived threats, then you'd have a similar conversation on with the other individual who's the other party, and allow them to co-create a space. And then you bring those agreements together. And then eventually you can have that conversation, that being in a circle or between two people. But it's important to actually to empty the container. So as you, as that bridge, as the person who is mediating conflict and or like conflict resolution coaching or in a restorative circle, it's important that the bridge, or the person who is being the bridge, to empty their container. So if I had a conversation with you, James, and then I'm going to meet with Aaron, I have to make sure that I establish myself and empty my container so I could show up fully for Aaron. After you and I may have had a very emotional conversation, you may have expressed some things that that are alive in you in the present moment that can stick to me, that resonate with my own trauma. So it's so important to have the type of skill set to be able to empty the container using mindfulness practices to so you can show up fully and not taint the next space that you go into.
So a question for you, it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that are you familiar with caucusing? So in there are different models of mediation, or in this case, conflict coaching, as you describe it. But in mediation, caucusing is where the mediator will meet with each party separately and will help to guide them to a resolution without the two parties being in the same space. Is that similar to how things are generally done, or does it just vary depending on the parties that you're working with?
No, I think that's right, James. So I think in restorative justice, that caucusing is a really important part. So making sure that we're aware of what's going on with all of the parties involved. And so the thing about restorative justice coaching, and it sounds like mediation, is that it acknowledges the humanity of the people that are involved. And so one of the things that we are really attuned to is the trauma that exists in all humans. And so in order to be able to resolve conflicts or to heal from a crime, it's important that we address the trauma of the individuals that are involved. And so it's, you know, acknowledging that, meeting people where they're at, and trying to work through those issues with sensitivity. But yeah, I think that's right. There's always an effort to build up, as Earl said, both sides or all sides of an issue ahead of time individually before bringing people together. Because there could be a scenario in which you actually don't bring people together. You know, that may not be the ultimate resolution. Because every resolution is actually unique, because it may turn out that the person who's been harmed just can't be in the same space with the person who is the offender. It might be too traumatic. So it's really, really important that people who are doing restorative justice are really aware of what's going on with all of the participants in that way.
Yeah, definitely. We would hate to bring two people into a space and have a conversation that causes more harm. So building their capacity to get into that space and be prepared to have a conversation to address the emotional needs that are a direct result of their past experience and the trauma that resulted from those experiences, as well as what led up to the conflict itself. So, you know, our lives are shaped by our perspective and our experiences in life. And as we move through life, similar situations kind of stack on top of something that happened to us, per se, when we were 7 years old. And continuously, you know, it's like a bump in the road. If you were to layer concrete over that bump, and then another layer of concrete. Eventually, it'd be a larger bump, like a big bump in the road. And I think, you know, having the conversations and understanding who you're dealing with, what they're facing, and how they deal with their own emotions and stress is important to know. So getting to know the individual, like I said before, those authentic efforts to create this connection is so valuable. And then that way you can assess if a person is even ready to come into a room to have a conversation with someone who caused them that type of harm.
This podcast is supported by our CUC Connect members, whose yearly membership includes free attendance to our live monthly webinars, 12 additional featured recordings of past training events, discounts to our basic and advanced training programs, and support from our network of certified trainers for continued professional development. Consider joining CUC Connect today and dive deeper into the understanding-based model. So it sounds like there isn't a one-size-fits-all path to take with each, you know, either two individuals or two groups or one large group with lots of people, that based on those individuals' experiences and in honor of them, that it sounds like the approach changes. It could start out separate. It may end up with people being in the same room together, working towards a solution, and that it really just, it depends and it's fluid. And it sounds like the work that you're doing is open to many different avenues, with the same end result being, trying to come to a place of healing, if healing can be possible between the two parties.
Yes.
That's right. Yes. And I think one more thing that's important is that it's always voluntary. And so it's always invitational and voluntary. And same thing with coaching. So the reason that we really believe in coaching, the reason it's evidence-based and being funded by governments now, is that it draws on the internal motivation of individuals rather than having things that you're supposed to do imposed on you by someone who's hierarchically above you.
How do communities find you if there's an opportunity for you to come in and assist them in these very sensitive conflict scenarios? How do people find you? How do you go out in the community to work?
Usually, so we do have a contract with the Healing and Justice Initiative, which is a resentencing pilot. And so what I do is provide coaching to individuals that have been resentenced in the California Department of Corrections and are being released into an opportunity for a restorative process, restorative circles and things of that nature, to try to bring forth the healing. So my role would be to support that person and to encourage and not enable, but to empower that individual and not be a case manager, right? That traditional approach of, you know, doing things for someone, how do I harness the power that lies within whoever I'm dealing with, whoever I'm coaching. So our visibility comes from doing the work. So one of the challenges that we've seen as a small grassroots nonprofit is the difficulties in plugging into government systems for funding, having enough time and visibility to earn the trust for government to want to work with you. So what we've been doing now is we created an LLC as well. So we've been working with the Homelessness and Supportive Housing agency in San Francisco around the 5-year strategic plan. So we've been doing community engagement. And so our community engagement efforts always embed coaching practices. We approach it with a restorative lens, as well as culturally competent with leveraging lived experience, my own lived experience, and the value that Aaron brings with understanding the legal aspects and the legal landscape of things.
We're in the community. And so people know the type of work that we're interested in doing, that we're into peacemaking and that we're into making systems work better. And so, you know, for example, Earl got a call last week to go to a school or to a group of young people and to help facilitate a restorative circle with kids that had been impacted by gun violence in that moment. It was so, Earl gets calls like that all the time. And a lot of times, most of the time, they're not paid experiences, but that's the way that we stay connected to community. And those experiences have allowed us to work with a lot of people and have given us the opportunity to spread these practices in a lot of different venues that we're really excited about.
Yeah, because, you know, if you think about coaching isn't accessible to desperately impacted communities. So the community engagement efforts give us visibility and allow us to talk to people and have conversations with folks who have never had access to mediation, don't understand that. So when they see someone who, for instance, like me, who's been criminally justice impacted, has been housing insecure, they see that common thread and feel a sense of hope. So, you know, this is why I lead with our story versus just my story. It's Alfonso and I that lead this effort. His voice, you know, I have to amplify and lift up his voice in order for this, to remain authentic and impactful. And just having conversations with people, and when we're doing this community engagement, it gives us access to folks that don't normally have access to not only coaching, but hopefully mediation. I'm looking forward to learning how mediation can amplify not only the story that I hold, that we hold, but our skill sets, our existing skill sets to provide, you know, because when you think about what's going on now in our communities, they're reflected by the leadership that we see, you know, this polarization, these dominant cultures that are about like this top-down approach. And so my belief is embedding trauma-informed approaches, which is that horizontal style leadership that Aaron was talking about earlier, where you bring value of community voice and you uplift those voices into the room where decisions are being made. And so that's what one of the things that was so beneficial and gratifying about doing the work that we just recently have been working on with HSH, or Homeless and Supportive Housing, is the fact that we can uplift community voice. And the reason why community trusts that we are going to have impact, because there's someone who has lived experience. We built a team of folks that had similarly experienced homelessness and are criminal justice impacted. So we can go into communities, build that trust, harness that trust, get not just have this extractive relationship, but be in power with and have relationship with folks that are currently experiencing homelessness, and help them to tell systems, instead of looking down and from that helicopter and that top-down view, where you miss a lot of the intricacies of what it feels like to be in, to experience homelessness or a criminal justice system, and allow folks that have experienced it, have navigated, to inform those system maker, those decision makers and system actors that want to approach it from a more academic lens rather than the experiential lens. So there's a lot of gaps that are created when you say, oh, we could use these quantitative data points, but where are the qualitative data points to tell the story of what the numbers look like and what the numbers result in?
Well, thank you, Aaron and Earl, for being here today to share the important work that you're doing to bring together individuals in conflict in the communities that you serve through restorative justice practice. Really appreciate you taking the time to share your work with others working in the conflict resolution community.
Thank you, James.
It's such a blessing. Yeah,
thank you so much, James.
Thank you for inviting and bringing out and lifting up Alfonso's voice. Thank you.
Earl Sims is the executive director and Aaron Kennedy, the board chair of Restorative Community Solutions, a nonprofit organization supporting individuals transitioning back into society from homelessness, incarceration, and treatment facilities through an emphasis on conflict resolution and restorative justice practices. You can learn more about their work by visiting www.restorativebayarea.org. Thank you to today's guest for being with us today, and to our CUC Connect members, whose support enables the Center for Understanding and Conflict to bring new perspectives in the field of conflict resolution and mediation to you, our listener, in each new episode. You can find out more about today's episode, along with full interviews and additional information about conflict resolution and mediation using the understanding-based model at www.understandinginconflict.org.